Freestyling the anchor, I'm write that shit. Freestyling the anchor, anchor. Freestyling the anchor, I'm write that shit. Freestyling the anchor.
Hey, hey.
Hello.
I'm Damon.
I'm Kiss.
And this is Ergo. And we're back with another episode where we do what we do, and that's transform the culture for the more liberatory and creative. How you feeling, Kiss?
I am doing well. It's been fun to get back in the flow of, you know, what we kind of cut our teeth doing. And I'm feeling the creative juices start to flow a little
juices
bit.
Are flowing. Those juices are overflowing over there a little bit. Clean up your juices.
Hey, you're the smoothie king.
I am
over
a
there.
Juice lover.
We've detailed this in the past, but I think it's worth naming. Just briefly, how many ingredients would you say go into your daily smoothie, Dame? This is hard-hitting journalism.
Easily 12.
That's a lot when you think about a smoothie, but that's not as many as
hold on, let's take
say.
A little editing break and I'm gonna count.
Okay,
so
we'll be right back.
Movie
after
magic.
These messages.
Kale, spinach, broccoli, celery, cucumber, pineapple, avocado, lemon, strawberry, frozen berries, and if we talk powders.
Let's talk powders.
If I got it all, I got a protein, I got a spirulina, I got a maca, I got a moringa, I got a fiber. We're talking about 15 ingredients if we count it up.
That's the recipe. We got to start like franchising this. I feel like if we play our cards right, the Respair smoothie bars are coming soon.
Mm-hmm. All about that regenerative nutrition, you know. And
speaking of regenerative,
you're going to be fully nourished with the amazing Kennedy Bartley. Kennedy is someone I've known and respected for a long time, and I really say sits the deepest at the intersection of understanding local electoral politics and grassroots movement organizing. And so it was really a gift and a pleasure to talk to Kennedy, not only about her work and her thoughts. We got some Waukegan backstories here. We got to laugh and have a good time. And then also really talk about how power works and operates, not just in our city, but in spaces around the world.
Yeah, for those who don't know Kennedy's work, Kennedy has been one of the lead organizers of most of the most effective progressive grassroots campaigns in the city, and has been furthering that work as the director of United Working Families over the last year.
And so since we've recorded this, Kennedy has transitioned out from UWF, but don't worry. They are going to keep doing really impactful work. They have a new landing spot. Actually, I have the scoop, but she didn't give me permission, so I'm not going to tell you. So stay tuned and follow Kennedy if you want to know where she ends up. We may promote it down the road.
But we're good
right
people,
now,
but bad journalists.
Yeah, no, I'm keeping that close to the chest. I'm not sure if she wants the word out, so the word ain't out until the word gets out.
Exclusive for us.
Just us.
You can check out the last time that Kennedy was involved with our platform. They were on one of our episodes of Through the Portal, which we did with the UIC Social Justice Initiative. And if you want to come across Kennedy, just find a way to get plugged into grassroots political movement happening in Chicago. As a reminder, there's an election coming up next week. Early voting is available now. And so if you want to make us and really make Kennedy happy and affirm all the work that they've done, this is a great time to go out and vote, maybe even in support of Bring Chicago Home.
Bring Chicago Home.
All right. We're at Ergo Radio. Make sure that you comment and review us wherever you get your pods. Also check out Respair Media, all the other work that we've been doing. And with that, let's get into it.
Oh, yeah.
With Kennedy Bartley.
What up, everybody? We are here, and I know y'all hear me say it all the time, and I'm usually being honest about it, but there is absolutely no exaggeration when I say with us, we have one of my favorite people in the world. If it is a day and I have some free time and I happen to be in the presence of our guest, I am elated and gonna leave happier than when I entered. So I'm happy to share this time with y'all. We have with us the one and only Kennedy Bartley.
What's up, y'all?
That's how we do it here.
Ooh.
It's a whole new spate of Ergo episodes, and I feel like we really are figuring out some new animals to bring to the table.
Watch this, watch this. This is out of the animals. Boom. A big old boom. just a big boom. We're in here.
Just like Sonic, little Sonic boom situation.
Yeah, boom.
So, Kennedy, long time friend of us and friend of the show. We had you on our Through the Portal series, but just full blown ergo, welcome. And we're going to start it off how we do. We're going to get into this thing. In this time, define time however you will. Your choice, dealer's choice. This hour, this day, this season, this lifetime, in this time. Kennedy, how are you treating the world and how is the world treating you?
All right. Also, thank you for that very sweet intro, Dame. It's, yeah, deeply reciprocated. You too, Daniel. I would say in both directions, yeah, like pretty well. People were like, what's your New Year's resolution? And I was just like, honestly, wellness, like in all forms of the word. And I'm feeling like really, really good. Like I'm like just like figuring out how to like get centered in the motion of things. And that feels good. And kind of like returning to myself. I hope that I'm like putting that into the world and just moving with a lot more like slowness and ease and intentionality. So it feels good.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
I'm happy when I hear people in response to that question think about how they're taking care of themselves. Not just how they're treating other people.
We get a lot of dread.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And I think particularly for the worlds that you spend your time in, it's one thing, you know, for us over here with microphones or, you know, our TJ practitioners or our yoga teachers to be talking about. You are in like profoundly unhealthy places, like places where people do not take care of themselves or each other. Obviously, there's exceptions within that, but I'm thinking like they're not built for care often. And so I'm wondering, in trying to center that for yourself, how are you thinking about care in the work that you're doing also? Because I think when it's at its best, those two things bleed into each other.
Totally. I mean, it's like for sure an uncomfortable practice, right? Like this idea of like slowness when I'm in like the throes of like the most fast paced, chaotic, unpredictable, unprecedented, like, I don't know, like, I guess minutia of things. And at the end of last year, I was feeling like some of the deepest despair that I've ever like found myself in. And it like worried me. And there was like this like guilt or pressure not to like take a break, I guess, to like mitigate the despair, because like the conditions that I was like, I think my body was like responding to was like, you know, a genocide. And it's like those folks don't have like the, you know, yeah, folks don't like necessarily have like the choice. And I think that my agency was like a site of guilt maybe. And then that stuff takes a toll. Like I'm like a really like somatic person and I feel that stuff chronically like in my body and like in my spirit and in my energy. And so I guess like slowness chose me. And I think, you know, I am the executive director of an organization. And so to the extent that I have like power and influence in that space, you know, I really do try to like just affirm like what people's bodies are telling them. And yeah, like live into like the values that we're about, you know, like so many of us are like anti-capitalists and, you know, like recognize rest as like both a form of resistance and just like what humans need because we're not machines. And at the same time, there's kind of like this built-in premise that like we'll go so hard. And then like whenever liberation comes, we'll like snap into this world of like rest. And, you know, and it's like, I just don't think that like, I feel like the journey matters, like how you get there likely matters. And so, yeah, try to like embed that into the work where possible. And sometimes it's like totally unrealistic, you know, and that like sucks. But like where I can, you know, build it in and take the time, I try to. And I, you know, I think I learn a lot from like comrades in the disability justice space around these like practices.
So in getting ready for this conversation, there was a segment, two points that I see you at. So when I'm saying segment, everybody, I mean like a line, but a line that's not infinite, you know, where, the, you know, there's this to this. But I really realize it's a triangle. There's three things about you that feel specific and unique and true and not hyperbolic. You are the person that I know that has the best understandings of the mechanics of grassroots organizing and the procedures of local government, right? That's what I was like, oh man, like how did, that's what I'm curious about is like, how did you find yourself in that? You don't, if that's uncomfortable to hear, don't worry about it. It's like true to me and there's nothing you can say to change it. But then there's also this third point where we be at meetings together cutting up and like, you also are like at the epitome of real nigga humor, right? So at first it was a line, but it's really this triangle. So as we talk about your brilliance and these intricacies that you have like uniquely found yourself in, I hope we could also make space for the fool you and like how hilarious and silly you are. But I want to go back. I met you, I think, in 2016. And like we've been in comradeship and around and really through Defund got deeper. But just as a young, vibrant person, how did you find yourself? You're more than just politically interested. You're like entrenched in the rooms where the decisions and work is happening. Was there a moment where you're like, oh, this is a path that I want to go down that led you to this knowledge that you hold?
Yeah. You know, I think oftentimes, like when I'm reflecting on like how I got into quote unquote organizing, I like talk about when I came to Chicago because it was in 2013. And I think that that was a time when a lot of folks like in my generation and our generation like cite as like a politicizing one, or like when they like first were like in the streets or like first like felt. Yeah, I guess like this like collective resistance. And that's when like groups like BYP 100 were coming online, which is like what I met you through, Dame, but mainly the functions. But I think like, and you know, like I was waking up very early when we would have like, you know, actions on campus, and I was downtown and I was laying on the middle of, you know, Michigan and all these things. I think that that was the thing that like raised, like was like consciousness raised and was like inspiring for me. But so much of how I orient to the work and what I think I like would credit any like directionality or trajectory that I'm on as I become a more reflective and honest person, like comes back to like where I come from and like who I come from and like the personal, right? And people say all the time, like the personal is political, the political is personal.
Who are we talking about here? Yeah, let's go back. When you think about that, who are you thinking of the people and the place that you're from that informs that?
So I remember very vividly, like, and I hate to like bring this up in like a, you know, trauma porny way, but it's honest, you know? So I remember very vividly like walking through the quad and getting a call about my little cousin, who's basically like my little brother, and he had passed from gun violence. And at the time I was teaching these restorative justice, like nonviolence, like classes in CPS. I was at Taft and Morgan Park. And it was like with young people like his age. And I just remembered like feeling like this sense of like, I can't even, I don't know, I struggle to like articulate the emotion, like the, but it was, I had to say like, it, that was the thing where I was like, whatever I'm doing, like that thing doesn't feel like it. It's like, I was in classes and I was like I was an African and Black diaspora studies major, along with, and this is really funny, people, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but I was also like a finance major and a philosophy major all at the same time. And my whole thing, because I was, you know, I was coming from Waukegan, I had no idea. I told the joke before, like my extensive knowledge about what organizing was like Marie Kondo, like, you know, making things neat. So, you know, I didn't have any like assessment of like the nonprofit industrial complex. And in my head, I was like, I do want to do like service work, because that's just always like been like kind of deeply embedded in how I was brought up and stuff. But I was like, I'm gonna be a finance major so that I could like do the finances of this nonprofit that I'm gonna start. And then when Trayvon passed, I was like, my cousin Trayvon, I was like, that's not it, you know, like that doesn't feel like it. And so, but I was feeling like this depoliticization and like radicalization, and like the path was right with like the African and Black diaspora studies. And then I became a policy major as well.
Hold on, I'm sorry, time out. We're now up to four. These are four potential majors.
No, so I dropped. So I should say I graduated with a major in public policy, a minor in African and Black diaspora studies, and a minor in geographic information systems. So I dropped philosophy and finance.
And a concentration in achievement. This is a lot. I'm just saying that's extensive.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Shut up. So. Yeah. It was extensive, but it made sense. And so, you know, through there, I think it became very clear to me that like policy was never, like I'd never really oriented per se, I don't think, to like policy as like the thing that's going to like save us. Like if I could just write the right thing, like I could, you know, but it did feel like as I oriented to like what organizing meant, and to what like building power meant, and to what winning meant, it was like another lever. And I was just like, And now I have, like, I think a more sophisticated vocabulary around what I'm trying to articulate. And it's like this idea of, like, you know, quote unquote, like governing power, or this idea that, like, there we have to contest for power across multiple arenas to really build, like, transformation. And so, like, policy is one of them, you know. And I appreciate you, Dame, for, I always feel so seen when we talk, because some people will, you know, orient to me as, like, just this leftist organizer, and others will, you know, orient to me as, like, this policy wonk. And it's never been like, it's all been like in service of the thing, period.
That's like, Kennedy used to, for years, like, prominently Harlem Shake at any place.
No,
where music,
yeah,
came, but that might not have been a requirement.
And that is probably, like, the truest.
A major in Harlem Shaking and a minor in policy is what I'm hearing here.
If there was a name that wasn't my name, it would be Harlem Shaker. You know, that is, like, the most, like, call me that. So that's, I think, how I find myself, like, in all of it, is, like, if there was a pencil to make the triangle visible, the pencil is being held by Waukegan and Benny and Teresa and Ollie and Faye. You know, like, where and who I come from, that has made all of it, you know, kind of just, like, I don't know. It feels like it just, like, happened. For me, like, what I do and how I do it just is, it makes so much sense to me, you know. But I really appreciate, yeah, the question. And I appreciate the visual too, and the capturing.
Yeah. And just want to, you know, love to Trayvon, and, you know, honor his memory and spirit, and condolences. And it's profound to hear how grief and transition shaped your whole relationship to the world and work. It's always fascinating to find folks, like, entry point or initial why. And I'm sometimes curious, like, how that why stays with you. But is there a time, what's the most recent time where you remember Trayvon's legacy and your love for him that shaped the way you showed up to your work? Like, that's what started it. What's the most recent time you remember it impacting you?
Oh, yeah, I really appreciate that. I mean, like, shout out the good young people of Good Kids, Mad City, for real. Like, it is, like, such, like, it is just so powerful to me, like, to be in the presence of, like, those young people. You know, like, I'll just be, like, talking to them and, like, fine, like, I'm just like, wow, I'm, like, making the deepest eye contact because I see so many, like, young people in these, you know. And that's, like, probably unfair to, like, put onto, like, a young person, but, you know, it's just, like, how they show up and how they take space and, like, how they model for us, like, what solidarity looks like, you know. Like, I'm seeing, like, 17-year-old, like, young Black kids at, like, protests for Palestine, you know what I mean? And it's just, like, man, like, that is, like, just, like, real, like, love and action. And I think that I talk a lot about, like, Waukegan, and very proudly say I'm from Waukegan. And I just, like, think about the ways in which people assess what it means to be, like, from a suburb, from an exurb, but, you know, and just, like, what the actual lived experience of, like, growing up there was. And I'm just like, man, I'm like, we need a Good Kids, Mad City everywhere, you know? And I think that, like, yeah, whenever I'm in this space with, like, you know, Miracle, of course, and James, you know, and I'm just like, I have so much, yeah, love for y'all, and y'all, like, hold so many, yeah, y'all represent, they just represent so many things for me. And it feels like, I think organizations like that are, like, rooted in, like, the love that I think probably exists in grief, you know.
Can we talk about Waukegan a little bit?
Please. Yeah.
I'm going to just embarrassingly say this will be an ergo first. I don't think we've mentioned Waukegan in the 300 some odd episodes. Dame, am I wrong? Yeah, I don't think so. And so
my memory is shot. So you can make many claims about what has going to happen and it's going to
fall. And so there's the political context, but I'm curious. I love to ask people this about where they're from and the place they grew up. Like, what are the sights, sounds, smells when you think about home that break through?
I would say the field house on Grand, where I spent many a summers and many a evenings post school hooping. And I would say the Cermak grocery store, where, like, post hooping, I would go and get tacos. And my grandmother's house and Foxcrest Apartments and, like, the playground, I guess, at Foxcrest, and the creek that we would jump over, and just, like, man, like, it is just such an institution for me, like, you know, Waukegan. And it's like, between this stretch of like Zion, Waukegan, and North Chicago was like everyone that I love the most, you know. And I love going back home, and I like don't have like the time to go back as often as I would like. But man, like, we had so many like just wild and like fun and silly and like definitely shouldn't have been there type times, you know what I mean? And yeah, I mean, it was a blessing, I think, to grow up there. And I don't know if I always felt that way, but yeah, I love it. I love it. And yeah, now a lot of my family is in like the Zion area, which is just like north of Waukegan. But we kind of all, it's funny, like all of us like from that area refer to it as LC, like Lake County. Because I mean, growing up, my conception of what it meant to be from Lake County was like Gurnee, North Chicago, Waukegan, Zion. But it also includes Lake Forest. And it's like, yeah, that's not what I mean when I say LC.
So let's place it geographically. We're talking like north, when people in Chicago think North Shore suburbs, that's technically Lake County, but that's not LC is what I'm hearing. So we're
exactly,
we're north of Lake Forest, Highland Park.
Right. That's right. But it's
along the lake, right?
But it is on the North Shore, which is really funny. But like our version of the North Shore has like 5 Superfund sites, you know, and it is like a site of like the highest environmental injustice, not the highest, but you know what I mean? So, yeah, but it's a wonderful place. And like, it's really close to like the Illinois State Beach randomly. So like sometimes folks know it for that, or like it being like close to Six Flags. I remember when I got to college, that's like how I described to people where I lived. But yeah, I love Waukegan. Shout out Waukegan.
That deep love of the place you're from, I'm going to match with the one time I was in Waukegan, which is not nearly nice enough of a story. But the reason I bring it up is because it does give a little bit of a sense of like how the geographic, cultural remoteness, this in-between space between when people think about like Chicago suburbs ending and then like south of Milwaukee into Kenosha, like it's in this very in-between space that I think a lot of people don't think about, but is much more tied to like industrial Great Lakes development and then deindustrialization than it is to, you know, fancy suburbs. And so my partner's mom and her husband were getting married at the Lake County Courthouse in Waukegan. And I walked in there, I was there and I was like, it felt like the first time I went in some ways to the southeast side, when I was like, oh, this looks like what photos, stories, imaginations, as someone who didn't grow up in Chicago, of what like the late 90s, early 2000s, before demolition, destruction, and then corporate rebuild looked like. And obviously that's a simplification, but it did feel like a little bit into this glimpse of like, oh, this is how, this feels much more connected to the rest of this region that I've seen than like when you head down, that, you know, you're seeing mansions along the lake and stuff like that. How do you, now being intricately connected to city politics here, how do you think people within those mechanisms think about the area that you're from? Or how does that show up? Do people think about that region being connected to the work happening in the city? How do those play?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. And now I'm glad that we're able to talk from like a political point of view of, you know, of the area, because that's spot on, Daniel. And I have like a lot of love for the west side of Chicago because it reminds me a lot of home. And I think it is that story of like industrialization, you know, great migration, deindustrialization. And I always tell the joke of like how many friends, and I'm thinking of like one person in particular, but like homies like that we would call Chi-Town. And those folks came when like Cabrini Greens was imploded, you know, or like during, like we could track the decimation of public housing in Chicago to like the folks in Waukegan and in North Chicago and in Zion. And my whole thing is like, if you care about organizing Black people, then you have to go where they are, you know, and if you care about organizing poor people, you have to go where they are, you know, undocumented folks go where they are. And they're in Waukegan, you know, like displacement, you know, like you follow the path, you know. And so like, I think that, yeah, it's like just such a political site, you know. When like growing up, my grandfather, the last job that he worked for like probably a majority of my life was at EMCO, which was like a chemical factory. And, you know, my grandmother worked at Sears until she retired. I mean, my mom worked on the base in the government. And these are, you know, like working good working class jobs. And like the idea of a union was like not anything that I had heard of, you know, until I was in college. And so there is just like so much like room for like organizing, you know, and I see so many similar conditions. Yeah. And so I think that there is a lot to be both learned from Waukegan, from like a policy, political like standpoint. And like there is so much to bring to Waukegan, you know, like on an organizing level. And yeah, it's really funny. It's like this place that's because we're also like, you named Daniel, like on the border of Wisconsin. And so like literally like you're just feeling like you're like both in the country and on the west side. Like it's so like interesting, you know, and it and like the presence of like the South like feel really like visceral as well. Because like my people come from Mississippi, the Delta. And, you know, and that's like the story of like most Black people there, or they come from Chicago after they were like either priced out or their homes were, you know, torn down. And so I don't think that people think much about, you know, a place like Waukegan. And I think it's because of this like idea that we have about like the suburbs. Yeah.
It's really interesting to hear kind of from the city, your retrospect and perspective of your home that was so much shaped by the structural realities of the city. And also, you know, from my understanding, you also have some like a little bit of split, like you did some high school in the city as well, right?
Close. Well, Matt.
My bad. But my question is, with that perspective, I'm really curious, what was your understanding of the structural realities of Chicago as you were coming into consciousness? And then what of that stays with you now, right? Like to be in a place that's so close, but yet distinct, but impacted by the realities of this metropolis, and now to be in the mechanics of it. Like, how did you think of the city? And does that shape the way you work, shape the way you interact with folks? Because you're not an outsider, but you had some distance, you know?
Well, Chicago never felt like this, like, distant, uncharted place. Like, I spent every other Saturday, like, in Miss Leoma's shop off of, like, Cermak, because that's where my mom got her haircut and pressed, you know what I mean? And like, and then we would like go around the corner to the Harold's, you know, or like stop at Lawrence's Fish, you know, like, and like, you know, concerts. I would either go to like Milwaukee, but more so like probably like in the city. And so I guess the fact that it was like a metropolis, it's like a lot of activity and stuff was like present here. And so we would come like to like a ESPN zone or whatever downtown.
Yo, ESPN zone was bussing.
You remember ESPN zone? Locked in, bussing. And then, you know, I went to high school.
My seventh grade ex-girlfriend made out in front of me with my best friend on his birthday coming from ESPN Zone. I thought I was done with her until I saw that. I'm like, dang, that kind of
you're saying he exited the friend zone in the ESPN zone?
Ouch.
Oof, that hurts.
Yeah. You know, it was intense. Wow. It was intense. Yeah, no, it was a big
good riddance thing. Then, I guess. You know, that's
Yeah. Didn't sleep well that night.
Really putting the Buster and Dave and Buster's over there.
Yikes, man. I should have told that joke.
Yeah.
That was good. As long as it happened, that was good. And then I went to high school at Loyola Academy, which is in Wilmette. You know, there were kids coming from all over. Most of my homies were either from where I was coming from. So I would take like the 5:56 a.m. Metro and we would freestyle on the way to school and we called it train tracks.
Uh-huh.
Pew, 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 pew.
Oh.
But a lot of the homies also came from out west, actually, coincidentally. So but there were kids from all over. And so I was also, you know, when I was in high school, I would come to the city just to, like, kick it, you know. And like a lot of my friends were like, you know, their grandmother stayed on like Laramie or Gladys. And, you know, so I was like, I had the perspective of being like downtown at ESPN Zone, out west, this one time like sneaking into Lala, and then like, you know, being at Miss Leoma's shop and sitting there all day, you know. And then my uncle was in the Nation. So we would come like far south when I would like, you know, go to like Temple with them. And so I think I had like a pretty like colored in perspective on Chicago. The idea, though, of like moving to Chicago to live felt like big. You know, I felt like I was probably like how people feel when they like go move to like New York or something. I was like, I'm in the big city now, you know? Yeah, but it didn't feel like.
You throw your hat in the air and it freezes in a steel shot.
Right. Right.
Didn't think I would get a Mary Tyler Moore reference.
I didn't know that's where we were going. I didn't know you had that. I didn't have that in me. I didn't know you had that. Yeah. Okay.
Nick I love Naked Night, Night. Yeah, threw my head in the air, and landed on the L.
Caused a delay.
Right, caused a delay.
And that's why we need to work on our public infrastructure. And that's what brought you to the work you are today.
The first time I was called a goofy. But yeah. So yeah. And it never felt like a foreign place, but it became, you know, even more expansive until it started feeling really small. And now I'm like, Chicago's so small.
When you first came to the city, what did you think, if we asked that version of Kennedy, what did Kennedy think that you would be doing, you know, 10 years later? Was there like this is the job I want, this is the type of thing I want to be doing? What was in the sights? Because I bet it wasn't what you're doing right now. That would be my bet.
Not quite, but not that. The reason I was a philosophy major is because I was like, they do really well in the bar and I think I want to go to law school. But then I also like have the thinking about like, you know, some like nonprofit work, like hence the finance. My freshman year, I like got an internship, or not even an internship, a job at Morgan Stanley. So I guess like there was like a slight second where I was like, is this gonna be my life? You know, but like I think like law school was always kind of like the thing most concretely. It's hard. Stuff like memories like that don't feel that present for me, but it certainly wasn't like as specific as this. Yeah. But this doesn't feel like such a shock either. Like when I would go visit like my grade school and stuff, I don't think that people were like shocked that I was like organizing.
They're like most likely to be the executive director of United Working Families. And so let's talk about what that work entails. You know, we've gone all the way back and I want to base it in the present. There's the like the way that you describe what the job is in formal terms. And then I'm curious, when you think about what in this role you spend your days doing, what would you describe that as?
In this moment, post 2023 municipal elections, that answer is like different than most of the time that I've been in this work. So I'll like, in the spirit of being present, talk about like right now. I think I spend most of my time kind of thinking about what this election, particularly the mayoral election, but also like the city council, like alder elections, means for like the mandate or like people's imaginations or desires. You know, it means people expect more from their government. People believe in like alternatives to like the current paradigm. I'm just like, how are we both delivering on that and also like raising people's expectations? And how are we using this new lever, right? You know, some like legislative, executive power or influence to like get us closer to that end. And so in more concrete terms, you know, I'm on a lot of phone calls and I'm talking to a lot of people and I'm like either at City Hall or like at a community meeting or like at this table or pacing usually. And it's just like, yo, like, how are we knocking out things like tree but not trauma, bring Chicago home, yada, yada, so that we like get to start making like structural demands, right? Like doing the thing that really feels transformative. And I spend a ton of time reflecting on whether or not where I am is of most service to the movement and to myself, and like trying to be honest about the answer to that. And when the answer is no, like being honest about like what shifts need to happen. And so, yeah, I think that it's also really important to like spend my time thinking about like vehicles, like the organization that I am the ED of, United Working Families, like think still like have the humility to think of that space as like a vehicle and not like the end all be all. And thinking about how we use these vehicles like to the thing. So yeah, I feel like that was kind of like a bit of like a theoretical or abstract like response to what my job is, but that's what it feels like it is.
And for folks who are unfamiliar but somewhat tapped in, right, like United Working Families is obviously critical in the election cycle and the progressive wing of city council and the fifth floor of the executive office. But these policies that, like, you know, folks who know and like Peace Book, Treatment Not Trauma, Bring Chicago Home are things that folks have been pushing for years and now are in a place that seem really fruitful and concrete. There's something that I wrestle with that I'm sure you have to face much more that I hope can be a prompt towards imagination. That's where I'm leading us to. So in this moment of, you know, the people who agree with us, people who have been with us, being in more concrete power in the actual institution of governing, it's created a tension for my brain, because the way I learned to talk about the world that I want was always about the long haul and always like, you know, there is limited immediate possibility in these levers of power. So that forces us to think bigger than that or to change our timeline and scope. But like where you sit and where a lot of the folks who are elected sit, like there is immediate, like now you have to do things. Now there is expectation that is a little bit more concrete and you have to negotiate and, you know, I don't want to use the word compromise because of what the weight that comes with that, but there's the real politic that comes into play. And so I want to do what you said, like this vehicle to get towards transformative things. Your job's not dependent upon it. If it don't happen, it ain't your fault. But for you, what are some of the policies that like are not on the table yet that you imagine or that you see or that excites you of like, oh man, in the Power Ranger universe where we all come together 10 years from now, here's the thing we're moving through, or here's the way we are framing transformation in these structures. Does that make sense? Did that fit?
I think so. Yeah. And I think too, just like if I could, this is like a small part, but like embedded in your question or like in your, like, I think framing was like this idea of compromise. And I think what I'm realizing is like what we're being forced to do is not necessarily compromise, but like think with greater dimensionality. I think it's like the dimensions that are now like entering the chat. You know,
that, you just did that. Well, you throw a ality.
You know, it makes sense.
You just did that.
I was 2 seconds away from freestyling. So a quick like.
It was about to be train tracks on the line. Let's
this
go.
Reality, dimensionality.
the fallacies
is the calluses of under- right. The palace birds and I need to learn. And
you better stop. But I think that what feels really exciting is that in our lifetimes, we have the possibility to return to like common good stuff, like the public stuff, right? We get to like housing for all actually gets to be a thing, right? Like we're in a position where we could do green social housing citywide in our lifetimes, right? You know, which is like a less stigmatized, more dignified version of public housing that also recognizes like the current late stage capitalist, like induced ecological disaster that we find ourselves in, like the eco-fascism that we're a part of. And we get to return to like community schools being like well-resourced and well-staffed and like well-attended. And we get to provide good union jobs. You know, we just like kind of get to recreate, rebuild like the social structure that government, I believe, like is in place to provide for people. And then like I think that is the thing that creates the foundation for people's like imagination. Like that's not imaginative to be like everyone should have a house, a job, good school, and you know, that's like foundational. And then it's like now let's talk about like what we need to thrive, right? Like now let's do like the fun stuff. And because of the hegemony that we find ourselves under of like neoliberalism and like, again, late stage capitalism and all these things, the return to like what's public actually is transformational, you know, because we're so like we've regressed so much. But then I think, you know, after that is like when we get to start doing like the things that are just like, I've been thinking a lot about like quality of life, you know, and like that coming from more than just like having like food to eat and like a job and yada yada, like that's just like what you need to survive. But I think quality of life comes from like joy and like rest and like getting to like spend time and all these other things. And that's, I think, I guess what I'm naming is we start thinking more about like these like socialist or like abolitionist futures. Because I do think that like when people have good jobs and good homes and good schools and all these other things, like they are better to themselves and to the people around them. I think that's how you create safety. And that allows you to start doing like the fun stuff.
You get the room to Harlem Shake.
Right. I haven't Harlem Shaked in years. So tired.
Conditions of neoliberalism have restricted those right. shoulders, you know?
Right. The neoliberalism is weighing me down. I can't even.
And I say that in jest, but I'm slightly serious because I don't know why, but as you were talking about folks having what they need and what becomes possible, one of the things that's like not super political, but is like the emergence of new youth-based cultures. Like that's what happens when space is available. So like, here's like the corollary. Basically like the entire funk movement is like based out of the Ohio industrial corridor, Dayton and, you know, all those cities over there, Dayton, Cincinnati. And really it was because their parents' generation got better jobs. And so then they had basements and instruments and then they made bands.
Period.
And then
yeah,
you get Bootsy
yeah,
Collar, right? Uh-huh. And so just like, I'm thinking about, you know, not to glamorize 80s and 90s in Chicago, right? But like we had the emergence of house, we had the emergence of footwork and juke. And like, you know, in the last 15 to 20 years, really the only youth cultural movement that has like taken off and been prominent. Well, bopping. I wanna acknowledge bopping and Fifi culture, but like I have this real relationship with drill of like I think everyone should have their poetry, but it is obviously like a degenerative, death-based cultural movement. And so like as you were talking about the reality of people having what they want, like I thought of, oh, what excites me from that is the possibility of like new youth culture. And like there needs to be a new Chicago sound, scene, move, way of dancing, rhythm that is possible when you have space.
So you can stop shaking the way people in Harlem do and you can start shaking the way people in Chicago do.
Right. I want a Chicago shake. Yeah.
So what I'm hearing in that and what you named was this like trajectory of we have the possibility to return to a basic need to whatever amount that was met in the past. But you named it as like returning to the idea of a public good, returning to an idea of public housing available, social housing available, but doing those in different transformative ways that then will make possible this, you know, next wave of transformation. And I, in general, am someone who agrees with that, of the idea that the state provides these things or the public provides these things and the mechanism, one mechanism to do that is through the state. There are people who would disagree with that. It's a tension that I've felt from other people of this idea of if what we're talking about is divestment and then investment, that happening within the hands of the state is something that for me doesn't make me like squirm, but for other people does. The idea that the state would be the ones funding housing. And so I'm wondering how you think about this tension of this kind of not idealized, but visualized commons funded by public money versus like the reality of the state that we encounter on a daily basis.
Yeah. And I want to be clear, like, I don't think of the state as like a neutral actor, right? Like, I think that there is like a state agenda. And I think it makes sense that people have like what I would call a reactionary skepticism of the state because they are reacting to the fact that for most of our lifetimes, like folks have quote unquote co-governed with like the people who have never been interested in our livelihoods. And so like the state as an actor has been like an inherent bad actor to so many people. And so like the distrust, the skepticism, all this, I think it makes a ton of sense. And I think that it misses the actual point, which is like what the state should serve as, not what the state has served as, what we believe the state based on our experience like could serve as. I think it's like what it should. And I think that what it should be is a place that is, you know, rooted in providing the most good to the most amount of people and then redistributing like the needs of those people, right? And like any of like the profits that come from like the services provided to those people. And I actually do think that that is like some of the height of my imagination and my desires. Like I'm not interested in anarchy. I also believe in organizing, particularly like in this context, in this moment, borrowing again from like Chile and Mi Gente, like in organizing against within and outside of the state. You know, but ultimately for me, organizing towards the end of the state providing for like its people, you know, for people. And so I do think that like we should target the state in our organizing because it, again, it isn't just like this, you know, emotionless or like agendaless entity. But I think like in targeting it, it's like to demand more from it, not to like eradicate it.
I agree. And Dame, I'm curious. This is a convo that like we haven't exactly had. How do you think about this question of like the spectrum to anarchism models and state-based?
I don't disagree. One, just want to acknowledge like I have heard anarchy framed in multiple different ways or anarchism framed and beyond like how we colloquially think of it. And so sometimes I hear people who are naming themselves and traditions of anarchy be closer to what we're saying than I think how it comes off popularly or colloquially. I agree. Here's how I think of it, of like, I like to go towards the vision and come back of like this state, the militarized nation state that that dominates and oppresses the whole world is like a fatal project, right? And within that, there are contradictions and nuance, but we are, I think, working to build new state formations. But I believe as long as humans have been human, they have created formal political economy. That's what my definition of a state is. Like, what are the, do you have formal institutions of governance and resource distribution? And so I believe we need to create a new state system and formation. I call it like an eco-state or a social eco-state. So from nation state based off a notion of a militarized people group to based off our ecological realities and like mutual relationship and new forms of governance. And so I think within that, the institution that we have now has the capacity to meet people's needs that get us to there because we don't currently have the capacity and the knowledge of how to build it. So similarly, I'll use a parallel. Similarly to like, if you give people houses in the 60s and 70s, they'll create funk bands. I believe if we give people what we need, they can actually commune, organize together and build new ways of governing. There have been instances in Latin America over the last 50 years of like, you know, anti-violent constitutional revolutions, right? Like the United States outside of San Marino, which is like basically a city-state money laundering hub, so it's not really a real country. The United States is the oldest constitution in the world that's still functioning. I believe we need to reconstitute, and it shouldn't be in these same borderlines. And so we need to use the levers that we have. I think that, you know, within, against, and outside of is like, you know, perfect way to think about it. Like CHA should house people. CPS should educate people. FHA should house people. We should have a national and local health service that makes sure people are not dying from preventable illness. And then when we do that, I don't think we should stay there, right? Like, I don't think that is the goal. I think that then can allow the generational transition that can be revolution. If we think of revolution as like the process towards building the new forms of governance that don't currently exist. But I think within doing that, I think y'all are in agreement too. I think we do have to forefront the resistance and the harm from a restorative standpoint, right? Like, and so that's where we have to be careful. I think liberals can appropriate some of how we talk about this in like this entity, because it has capacity, therefore is valid, right? Like, I think we need to name it's invalid, name that it is abusive, not in, like Kenny said, not as a neutral site, and like be in agreement that the goal is to get somewhere else. But we have no other vehicles that have the resources or the capacity to get us there. Dang, you got me with that. I had a question. But like,
if you ever want to derail Damon, just ask him what his vision is for a new world. Yeah,
if you ever
really
want
to throw him up his game.
Oh, I got it. Thank you. Okay, so I think that was really healthy, actually, for something you named that I want to dig into that I think is really important to your job and to this political moment in this city and region. You said, to paraphrase, like, what has been the norm is that like co-governance has happened with people who are not interested in the well-being of people, more or less. It's not exactly the sentence you use, but that's
like
what
in our livelihoods. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I want us to unpack this notion of co-governance, like, you know, maybe a working definition in general of like what you understand that term to mean. And, you know, a big part of this moment of this post-election season is ideals and excitements and dreams and visions of new forms of co-governance. And so I want to unpack where that sits with you. So what does it mean and how does it feel? What does it look like? What is possible? What is maybe some of the challenges?
Sure. Yeah. I feel like I haven't done much of like a thought exercise around co-governance in some time now.
That's what we're doing here.
You're doing work exercises.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And yeah, because like, it's like we've been doing the work exercises. Because, you know, before, like when it was clear, like before, you know, the mayor was inaugurated, before the inauguration, I felt like the task of UWF was going to be out of the gate defining co-governance. And, you know, over the years, I've read a lot about co-governance in the context, mainly from like the Global South and, you know, like in like MST in Brazil and, you know, in Spain and South Africa. And the MST has this idea of like contentious co-governance, which the premise essentially is if we are doing our jobs right on the outside, you know, we will be working to make sure that like the most good is being brought to the most amount of people, and contention will be created because we'll always be demanding more, right? Like you meet the need and it's not enough and it's not enough. What became clear to me after the inauguration was that there actually wouldn't be enough time for like these philosophical exercises. And I don't know that they necessarily matter, because like what matters actually is like governing and organizing people to demand more and meeting needs, however that happens and whatever you want to call it. And so I like find myself these days using the language of like inside outside strategy more often, because it just seems like less of like a, it provokes less like devil's advocates, you know? And in the Chicago context, you know, there's, I think the lineage and like the legacy of Alinskyist like organizing is like feeling very present for me. Like this idea of like, it doesn't matter who is in like these elected seats, they're the target just inherently. And I'm like, elections actually do matter, and who are in seats like actually do matter. And like the ways in which we like talk about inherent targets feels like incredibly unstrategic to me now. And it feels difficult to like even think about co-governing when people are like kind of feeling like bashful about like even like claiming the power that they have, or like claiming proximity to power, or like naming their influence. And I actually think that that's like super harmful to our movements. Like in any room, I'm like very honest about the power and the influence that I have, because I'm not interested in hoarding it. So I have no reason to hide it. But I think that there is like this need, and they talk about this in Rev and Ev, Dame, about, you know, after...
Do we have a Boggs bell?
We need a Boggs bell.
Dale,
y'all definitely
need a Boggs bell.
I'm shocked, actually, that there isn't like a ding, ding, ding. Yeah, maybe if it was like an evening podcast, we could be like, take a shot if someone references Rev and Ev. But in it, you know, there was like the little note on, not the little note, but there's like the portion on, you know, 1917 Russia and like Lenin's reflections about like the need for a cultural revolution too, you know, because like now it's like, okay, we own the means of production and now nobody want a union, like mugs don't want to organize no more, you know? And so I do think that there is like a lack of shared analysis and assessment. And I think that because we've never had to think about it as dimensionally, we don't necessarily have the strongest language or understanding of like what power is and who has it and how you lose it and how you use it and what like the difference between power and influence are, you know? And so like this idea of co-governance feels so like cart before the horse. That's where I'm living these days. And I'm definitely interested in like winning stuff for people and with people, and less interested in like what we call it. The how though matters too. Like how we do it does matter still, you know? But like the language of like what we are like ascribing to like the process doesn't feel as important. Like whether we call it inside outside strategy, co-governance, you know, like whatever gets us to like the work part the quickest, you know?
Yeah. Is that shift from like seeing how this like actually works over the course of a year? Like that would be my guess, is like whether you want to call it urgency or just like forget the label for it, let's do some shit that actually works, comes from just being in that building, right? Or in those conversations, right? Would be my guess.
Yeah, and comes from like what feels like arrogance, I guess. Like to believe that like people elected us to spend or like elected this government for us who are largely responsible for that election to be spending time defining what we're doing, you know, and not that that doesn't matter, but it's like what matters more again is like this mandate that I'm like, that I was naming that I spent a lot of time like thinking about, you know, and it's like there's like this idea of like the narcissism of small differences, you know, like don't allow yourself to be like so thrown off, you know, but and I see that like when we're like negotiating for policies, you know, or like when we are, you know, constructing like the exact language we're going to use in an ordinance. And don't get me wrong, that's like the minutia matters sometimes, but sometimes it's just arrogance and narcissism, you know? And it's like, I don't feel like that's what we actually are like building power for. Right. And I don't think that that's what like the majority of people in Chicago elected this mayor and like that city council for. And again, I really don't want this to feel like, you know, I'm like anti-intellectual because I feel like that's not me at all. And it feels ahistoric and all these things.
Anyone who's listened up to this point in the episode knows that's not
okay.
The case.
You're pro.
Yeah, I'm super pro.
We heard those majors.
Yeah, exactly. You know, pro-intellectualism, anti-pretentiousness, I guess. Or like anti, like, you know, like I'm just like, let's, you know, let's do it. And I think it's important that we make assessments along the way. But there is like just some like certain levels of like cynicism that aren't necessarily like rooted in like the amount of people prematurely dying or like freezing outside. And it's rooted in like these like more philosophical exercises that feels like exhausting and like it's missing the point.
So as we're winding down, where we just got to feels really rich. And I want to give you some time to like go deeper because you started by naming a tendency for folks to be bashful about the power they have and not claiming it. And then you also said folks may not understand what power is and the difference and distinction between power and influence. And so as we're here, just like want you to talk more about your understanding of power and like if folks are veiled and how they see it, like from your kind of inside outside position, how do you think people should understand power?
I think that anyone that believes that us winning the mayor's seat means that overnight we can do all of these transformational things has like grossly misunderstood what we've been up against up until this moment. You know, like the real estate lobby is still as rich as it always has been. The FOP is still as fascist as it's always been. You know, like all of these things that we have been fighting against don't get absolved. And I think people put so much stake into like this one sphere of like contested power that they like miss the like what is necessitated by like our opposition, right? It necessitates us to like still organize, you know, like still contest, like still do like the things. And so really like this election was a process victory on this larger art, you know.
I've heard you a lot of times in meetings use the language of stress test, right?
Yeah, like a stress test
uh-huh. for our capacity, right. Structure test to organize that the whole city, right? Like a mayoral election is something that the whole city then participates
yeah.
in. And so the result of that is then to further organize, not to put in saviors or to put
that's
in people
exactly
to do
right.
the politics for
right.
you.
Right. That's exactly right. And I think that that's the part that is, I think that's the part that's missing. And so for me, I'm very honest about the fact that like, I've known the mayor for some time now. I've known like the people working in City Hall now for some time and all this. So I have some influence. I am the executive director of the organization that many people credit as being like the nexus for all these organizations and individuals like winning this massive, unprecedented election. As the executive director, that comes with like a level of like influence that like, you know, an organization that I may work very closely with, but is like smaller or doesn't have the relationships or newer, like doesn't have. And I think it's really important for me to name that. Otherwise, it's suspect, right? Like, and so I think like the way that I understand power is to understand that we still aren't the majority. We still don't have the most power. And we can't absolve ourselves of responsibility because we have a lot more power than we ever have. And we have to do something with that. And we have a lot more influence than we've ever had. And so we have to do something with that. And we have to be clear about like how we lose the power that we have amassed, like if we don't show up.
I love that understanding of the tenuous nature of holding power, of like the amassing of it doesn't stay static if you don't do the thing. Like that's where, not to go back to this idea of co-governance, but that's the idea of that power being derived from the people who put you in that seat is like not just lip service. It's like, no, it's in your self-interest to do the things of the people who put you in that seat when you're able to with the power and influence that you have.
Totally. Because the math is mathing, and the math said you won, you know, 51%. So like, just keep doing that, you know, like where possible, you know, or keep striving to do that. You know, this mayor will likely do like a lot of like the hashtags that we have been talking about, you know, TNT, Bring Chicago, that stuff will probably happen in the first 2 years. And so it's also like with the power that we on the outside have, it's like our responsibility to keep making demands. Otherwise, like the noisy minority is going to like be the only constituency that exists for him to respond to, you know? And so I think that one thing that I will say about co-governance is like it also comes with like co-responsibility. And that isn't to like make peers of like the mayor and like people who are not elected and don't have like the power of that seat. And at the same time, it's just to like be clear about like we are not absolved of like our responsibility either, right? Because we are the ones who convince a bunch of people to like vote for this person, so we have to like make good on our word, you know, or strive to.
That's so interesting, because I've thought about that a lot with the like specific policy positions and initiatives and, you know, referendum that were like central policy planks of the campaign. In this case, or in any case, like we kind of have around electoral politics this idea that like politicians need to deliver on their promises, as opposed to like we're trying to have people who, as opposed to what I think a lot of people hope or think is someone who's ideologically aligned, right? And I think it's really important that someone doing the things they said they were going to do doesn't mean that they've completed doing their job. We have so few examples of that actually happening from an elected official that it's kind of like, oh my God. And that should be, to your point earlier, like the bare minimum. This is the floor, not the ceiling of the transformation we're trying to make possible.
Because there is something to be said about like if you only do the right thing because people are looking, right? Like that is like the definition of integrity is doing the right thing because it's like the right thing to do. And that's why I think politics and ideology like actually matters, right? Like that's where I trust people who have a politic. Or particular politic and a particular ideology, you know?
I always say that when people are like, oh, we need to be intentional. I'm like, yeah, you can have a lot of intentions, you know?
Right, right.
To what end?
To what end? That's right. No, that's exactly right.
Yeah, I think let's end. Yeah. We got to this end. And as we end, as was my worry, we captured a little bit of how funny you are. And I knew it wasn't going to happen because I knew you were going to be in work mode. And that's just what it is. I want to just open.
We have to have you back on. Regular correspondent.
Exactly. Is there any room?
Like you want me to tell a joke?
I don't want you to tell a joke. I'm curious, Dame, because we have spent a lot of time talking about how hilarious you are. And I'm not putting you on the spot to be funny. But Dame, I'm wondering if you have any stories that come to mind of like a time where Kennedy really had you falling out. Or Kennedy, a moment where you know you really got Dame or got both of us or anything like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that might be easier. Because
anytime we're... Okay. Anytime Damon and I are in space, whether it's virtual. And you too, Daniel, you also are a victim of this. Anytime we are in space... I'm like, oh yeah. And it just like, it gasses me. I'm like, I have to keep going. You know, I'm just trying to figure out an appropriate story.
I remember one. I don't know if I'll be able to recreate it in ways that's funny to other people's ears, but it was during defund. We were having a like leadership retreat and like doing some big all day strategizing outside the garden. And I think we were power mapping somebody or saying, I can't remember who we were talking about, but we said, oh yeah, they're like the Dandada. And somebody sat next to us was like,
Dada.
And we were just so amused that they had everything. And like, we couldn't explain it besides saying
the
just
Don Dada.
And then we just continued using it through the rest of the day.
Yeah, I don't know how I would explain what a dandada is.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it was one just like that we had to short, because we weren't like being facetious or like looking for a lab. We were like actually talking to each other. It was like, oh yeah, they're like the da-da. Like to get yeah. And then we had to stop and realize that someone didn't know what that meant. And it fucked us up. And so when Kennedy got the job, she was calling around of like doing her community relationships of like, hey, I just want folks to know, you know, I'm in a position of power. Now, as you say, you modeled it, right? Like I was with Daniel, actually. We were recording to help this garden grow. And you were like, you know, I'm still in the ground and like, you know, I'm with the people and like, I'm taking this. And I was excited. I was like, oh shit.
You're the Don Don.
Oh, that's so funny.
I remember that day. I was driving down Cermak when I was on the phone with you and you
he was all nervous. Like, yeah. You know, I hope you're
hope we
okay
can still be friends. Like,
nah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I said, my number's going to say the same. He said, nah, you're the Don Dada. That's dope. I was like, yeah. I am what cannot be defined.
So that's a small, minuscule glimpse.
Oh my God.
Just the mini way. Sometimes it's unspoken too.
That's the part.
I remembered one, actually, Dame. I know I asked the question, but I remember one while you were talking, which was the night that Brandon won afterwards when we were getting a drink around the corner. And you had a line that still to this day kills me. Which we were just like all go, Dame, do you remember the line I'm talking about?
That's it.
So we're doing like each person was doing a toast and what they, you know, hope that the future will be. And you just looked at this crowd and you just looked at this group and said, we might not have come on the same ships, but we're in the same boat now.
Which, that's just, so profound.
Just profound and
but hilarious.
Just such good writing.
That's MLK. Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny.
I think that night too, Daniel came up to me and was like, yo, you're really funny.
Because I'd only, like, I'd only known you in like formal context. And Dave has been telling me for months, like, no. You don't even know.
The funniest person in every room. Maybe.
And the real like conceit of the work we do is that we're really just looking for someone funny. Like all these interviews, like, yes, it's great the work, but like, can you get in the playground with us here? So thank you for being
thank
here and
you
being
guys
part of the show and for the work you're doing of navigating really, you know, complex realities and fighting to, you know, keep people's and fighting to help people's needs be met. Very
thanks,
appreciative
y'all
of the presence you hold.
As we close, are there any calls to actions or things people should know or plug into or ways you want to be found and or seen on the internet?
So I guess the only way that you can find me on the internet is Facebook, Kennedy Bartley. Or on Twitter, Kennedy _Bartley. Yeah. And any calls to action will be very present there.
We're at Ergo Radio and at Respair Media. I'm at Ergo Kiss.
I'm at Dama _AF.
And we'll be back reshaping the culture for the more liberatory and creative.
Much love to the people.
Peace.